do something that is different. And you look at all the heroes, and that's what they do.
The commitment to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
In terms of who do you want to be, articulate that. Find the words behind that. Who do you want to be?
Welcome to the final episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast for 2023. Now, it goes without saying that given this is our final episode for the year, I wanted to feature a special guest, someone who I call a friend and who, in a very short period of time, really, has supported me in my journey of personal growth. Her name is Penny Lacasso, and today is the second time I have had her on the podcast. Why? Because as her journey has evolved, so has her wisdom. Last time Penny and I chatted, we unpacked her book, Hacking Happiness, and explored the art of intentional adaptability. However, more recently, true to her word, Penny has pivoted her work. Today, her purpose is to help busy women to prevent burnout and spark joy so that they feel alive and present in life again. Now, over the next few weeks, we'll be taking some time out to plan this next evolution, although we may surprise you with a few holiday bonus episodes during that time. We will be officially back on the airwaves on the 24th of January. So strap yourselves in and get ready to dive into our theme for 2024, which will be all about what I am calling circular influence. In the meantime, have a truly wonderful Christmas and New Year. And for the last time this year, welcome to the DNA of Purpose. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast for a second time, the one and only Penny Lacasso. I am so excited to have you beaming back into the studio once again.
It is an honor to be invited back for another time.
Well, and I am very excited because I really feel like today's conversation is going to be a true evolution, which is the theme that we are now exploring in season 5 of the podcast. To get things started, I'm going to ask you a question that I've been asking all of my guests on the podcast this season. And it is simply this: what question is currently guiding your life or your work forward at this exact point in time?
They always say when the student is ready, the teacher appears. I feel like it's the same with questions. Mm. Like you asking that question just seems so poignant in terms of where I'm at and the point I'm at in my journey. So if I think about the question that's guiding my life at the moment and the work that I do with my clients, it is, who am I at my essence? Who am I when I strip back the layers of should, the layers of unrealistic expectations that have been placed upon me by myself, by society, by people I respect and care about? Who am I when all of those layers are removed? That's what I'm curious about, because I've come to realize in the work that I do and in enabling women to flourish in life, it's not that we're fixing ourselves or changing ourselves, it's that we're actually returning home to who we were born to be. That's what I'm curious about at the moment.
I love that. And it really makes me reflect as well, because as you know, in terms of my work in the past, much of that work was really focused on the question of who am I becoming and what does that look like? And as I've gone through my own, I guess, burnout journey, which we're going to be talking about a little bit today, I've actually flipped that question considerably to who am I unbecoming? And, you know, I think it aligns so much with this idea of what it is to discover our essence.
I love that. I'm definitely going to use that, and I'll quote you in terms of, you know, but it speaks to, again, this relentless pursuit to strive, to be better. Yeah. And what I think it's great to have goals. I think it is great to strive. And there are so many benefits in terms of motivation, fulfillment, all of those things. But I feel like there is an absolute imbalance in the striving, because it's coming at the cost of presence. And it's leaving, from what I see with over 200 depth interviews with amazing women who have had success that are burnt out and feeling like no one's getting the best of them, it leaves them feeling like they're never enough, like it's never enough. And I think the really interesting question to ask ourselves is, how much is enough? Like, without an answer to that question, you'll spend the rest of your life striving for a goalpost that can never be met because it's not clear.
And this is such a beautiful umbrella for the remainder of our conversation over the course of the next hour. However, before diving right on in, I'd like to step back in time a little bit. I just mentioned that the theme for this season is all about evolution. And so I'm intrigued to learn what triggered this evolution for you, the work that you're now doing in supporting high-performing women who are experiencing burnout, and how has this new purpose created transformation for you personally?
Oh. You ask good questions, Beg. What I think is interesting about chatting to you today is that it comes full circle, because when we met, what I was doing, you know, it was a stepping stone to where I am now, but it was completely different, right? I was an international speaker. I was doing a lot of work in corporates, workshops and things like that. And I was doing work that was meaningful to me. But where I am now compared to that, which must have been like 5 years ago, I think we met.
Yeah, it was around the Singularity University conference in Sydney was when I met you.
It just feels like poles, like it's part of the one journey, but it just feels so far apart. And in terms of time and what has happened. So if I think about the work that I do now and the evolution of it, I think there was a couple of pivotal moments, right? And the first one was COVID. So as someone who was traveling the world, speaking on stages, someone who loved human connection, COVID came in and basically cut that off completely. And so all the things that I loved doing now were delivered online. And, you know, look, it's great that during COVID we could still work, but I just found that spending all my time online doing what I thought I loved felt like my soul was being sucked out. And I questioned a lot whether I wanted to continue on, because it just felt disconnected. And I think that was brilliant, because they always say it's in the pain. Gabor Maté, who I'm studying with, says where there's tension, pay attention. And I love that. So I was like paying attention to the tension and all of this resistance within me is, why am I not enjoying this anymore? And I was like, you know what? I'm not in a plane anymore. I have way more time because I'm not traveling. Work's not as busy. What are all the things that I've wanted to do my whole life, dreamt about doing, that I haven't done because I haven't had the space? So the first thing I went and did was my yoga teacher training. The second thing that I did after that, because COVID lasted a lot longer than what we thought, especially living in Melbourne, was I went back and studied psychology at the age of 47 and got my grad dip in psych and went, hang on a second, I've just done 10 subjects in psych and not one of them's touched on trauma. And the number one challenge that I see that's holding my clients back from realizing their potential, from returning to the woman they were born to be, is a layer of trauma. So I can't serve them unless I go and study this. So I decided to go to the best as far as I'm concerned, which was apply to study with Gabor Maté. And so I've been doing that for the last 6 months. And I've got to say, like, all of those sort of stepping stones has led me to the point where I become laser focused on, I want to work with women, and especially women who are in positions of influence, in positions of leadership, because these are the women that I think will be able to shape a different kind of future, a more human and more compassionate kind of future. And these are the women that are burning out at the highest rates we've ever seen.
So to frame that up a little bit, you mentioned before that you have interviewed 200 high-performing women in the past year to understand what holds them back from flourishing. And in this process, you had to refer an astounding 25% of those women to a GP for a burnout assessment. So I'm curious to know, with that in mind, how do we as women go about achieving balance? Or is that even a realistic target in this conversation? Like, that's a huge amount of women from 225%.
Yeah. So the first thing I would say is really fascinating to me is often women don't realize that they're burnt out until their body shuts down. And I know this because that was my experience in my corporate world. I didn't know when I was in the corporate world that I was burnt out until after I left. And what I see consistently, especially of those women that I've referred, is that women are very good. Like, we can normalize anything. And because these women are high performing, they're very good at normalizing operating in overdrive. It becomes their new baseline. So that's the first thing that I would say. Is balance achievable? I think that the notion of work-life balance that we've been sold is bullshit. If you look to a dictionary definition of balance, it speaks to equilibrium, which speaks to every aspect of your life being, you know, like a scale in perfect balance with one another. And the reality is that is not life, and that does not accommodate for the uncertainty and the unpredictability of life, nor does it account for the life stage and how what we need to give priority to during the different stages of our lives, especially for you and I as mothers, for example. And the age at which our children are at will inform a stage of motherhood. The notion of balance doesn't accommodate any of that. And so I actually feel like trying to achieve balance leaves many women feeling not enough and wondering why they can't do it. And so I like to speak more to the idea of harmony. What would it look like? What would it look like to inject a couple of micro moments of harmony into each day? Because if you can do that, it will help you feel more grounded and present. Mm-hmm. And what most of these 200 women have told me, when you ask them at the very core what they want, it's, I want to be more present. I want to be in the moment because I feel like I'm never in the moment, which makes me feel disconnected from myself and disconnected from the people that I love.
And it comes back to presence again and reconnecting to our essence and actually slowing down enough to do exactly that.
Correct, but the layers of expectation are that you need to be productive. You need to be striving, you need to be achieving, otherwise, you know, you're not doing enough. You can't be the perfect mum, look the perfect way as a woman, you know, be the high-performing, successful career woman. Like, these layers of being all of that and more, it's just exhausting.
Yeah, it reminds me of another podcast that I was listening to where the guest who was being interviewed spoke about a general, I guess, leadership philosophy in the context of that conversation. But what they were talking about is this whole idea of being too busy to be brilliant. And it reminded me a lot of a recent LinkedIn post that I saw you share with regards to this whole notion of busyness being absolute bullshit, essentially. And the way we use this concept of I'm just so busy as like a mask to kind of hide away from the real issue, which comes back to these layers of social expectation around who we think we should be.
Busy is a brilliant way to avoid what's going on inside of you. Yeah, busy is a way of filling your time, you know. So what you see with busy people is that every waking moment is full. And so what that does again is it disconnects us from ourselves because we're so caught up in the doing. And yet it is in the being. And when I say being, you know, you don't have to be sitting on the yoga mat all zen, but I'm saying it is in being connected and present in micro moments throughout the day that our body and our brain recharges. So there's a brilliant theory called the conservation of resources theory, a psychological theory, and it speaks to the fact that, you know, we are all just one human and we're all constrained by 24 hours in the day. And when you wake each morning, you get a set level of mental and physical resources available to you. Now, if you think of yourself a bit like a mobile phone and the little battery on the mobile phone, how you choose to use those resources throughout the day will determine whether they're depleted and the warning light goes on and starts flashing, or whether those resources are recharged, which means you're operating at your optimum. So when we don't take micro moments of recharge throughout the day and instead have that mindset of I'm just going to jam everything in and I'll take a holiday in 4 months' time, what happens is the warning light goes on, telling you it's time to recharge. And what I see is most of us have gotten really good at ignoring our body's warning signals because, again, we're disconnected from ourselves. We're disconnected from how we feel. And then what happens is we end up in a state where, you know, women say to me, like, I struggle to get out of bed. It doesn't matter how much sleep I have. I'm always exhausted. I get to the end of the day and the only thing that I have capacity for is to sit on the couch, pour a glass of wine and watch Netflix. And I struggle to decide which cereal brand to buy at the supermarket because I'm so decision fatigued.
And I'm really curious to understand what is happening at a physical level, like what is happening to our nervous system when we're in this state? What is actually going on inside of us?
Yeah, that's a very good question, right? So you have what's called an autonomic nervous system, which means, as it sounds, it's automatic. Okay, so when it feels threatened, okay, not in terms of life threatened, but when you feel threatened during the day, you know, that autonomic system will kick in. So what happens when you feel every minute of every day without the recharge? Your body basically goes into fight or flight mode because what it has to do just to get through, because it's got such limited resources, is shut down everything other than the resources you need to just get through what's in front of you. So your brain goes into survival mode. The rational reasoning centers shut down, which is why decision-making is extremely hard. Mm. It's hard to think innovatively, creatively. It's hard to think long-term because your brain's going, we just need to keep her safe and get her through the day ahead of us.
Mm.
So your central nervous system is hyperstimulated. Now, here's the thing. If we go back to the conservation of resources theory, if you don't recharge your batteries and keep pushing through day after day after day, the science tells us it's not a matter of it's a matter of when. Because your central nervous system is so hyperstimulated without a break, you open yourself to so many wonderful opportunities for disease, for gut issues. Like there's such a myriad of things that become available to us when we compromise our immune system off the back of long-term stress.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm really happy to share some of my personal story here because what reconnected you and I is an incredible breakthrough call, and I got so much from just literally from like half an hour with you. I like walked away with a new life plan. So thank you for that. But in looking at my story, there are two things that I think are really interesting. The first one that I found interesting is that when I was actually in an environment, a situation that was leading me down the road to burnout, I was completely unaware of it.
Yeah.
What have you learned from all of the depth interviews you have done, all of your clients, about this kind of, I don't know, ignorance bubble that happens to us when we're doing all of the things that are completely depleting that battery that you've been speaking about, but we somehow just don't see that we're doing this to ourselves?
I think there's a couple of questions that would be really helpful to ask yourself. And the first one is, if I drop out of my head, because I'll guarantee you people who are burnt out are spending all of their time in their head pretty much. Because the head is the doing, right, in terms of it's the catalyst for the doing. So if you drop out of your head and drop into your body, ask yourself, how do I honestly feel? What is the feeling and where do I feel it in my body? And what I often hear in response to that from women who are burnt out is sadness. I feel sad. And when I ask them how long they've felt sad, most of them have felt sad for more than a year. But again, because they've busy is a great way to disconnect from the sadness because it's a good distraction to keep going. So ask yourself, if I connect into my body, what is the true feeling that I feel at the moment? And where do I feel it in my body? Because it's a really good connecting into the, it's a good way to help you start to train yourself to connect into your body. Mm. The second thing I would ask you to consider is, how connected do I feel? On a scale of 1 to 10, how connected do I feel to myself and to the woman that I want to be, to how I want to show up? And how connected do I feel to the ones that I love? And if that number is lower than you would like and you're feeling sad, to the point where that number's low enough for you to say, oh, I actually feel disconnected from myself and from the people I love, I would say the best thing you can do for yourself is to go to a GP and get a burnout assessment. You can do a quick and dirty one online, which will give you an immediate indication of where you're at. But if you go to a GP, they can give you a myriad of things in terms of, you know, they can give you time off work, which I would always advocate, because taking a day off is never going to be enough. And they can also give you, you know, health plans. They can support you if you need a psychologist. Like, a lot of the women that I coach do see psychologists as well, or psychotherapists. That's where I'd go with that.
Mm. The other thing I observed, which just came to mind when you were talking about the battery metaphor earlier in the conversation, was once I got to the point where I realized I had in fact reached burnout and that I needed to stop, I then realized that I had no idea how to simply be, that it was all, that I'd almost become addicted to doing, to having my phone, to having the thing, the next thing happening and the next thing happening, that when I stopped, I almost had an anxiety about this vast space of emptiness for which I felt I didn't belong, or that felt very unsafe, really.
Oh, Beck, that's such a... Can I ask first, though, you said when I realised, what made you realise you were burnt out? What was the moment where you went, oof, this is not right?
Yeah, it's interesting. It was about 6 months in, and at that particular point in time, I was like, and I'm sure many women would relate to this, I just need a holiday. I'm going to have a holiday and then everything's going to be fine. And so I think in that holiday, I had some sense that things weren't okay, but I still hadn't really connected the dots that I had to fundamentally change my habits, all of those mini moments that were essentially creating an energy leakage is the best way that I can describe it. So I think I had some level of awareness at that point, but it wasn't until I actually got to complete breakdown point and made some really radical decisions off the back of that and literally jumped off a cliff. Yeah. It probably wasn't until a few months even after that that I went, oh, wow, I was in a really bad way. So it wasn't really until afterwards that I really comprehended where I was at emotionally, mentally, physically.
And then when you realized that you felt like you didn't belong in being, because it was such an unfamiliar feeling, tell me how you dealt with that.
I'm still dealing with that. If I'm really vulnerable, I haven't figured that one out yet. I've certainly implemented processes that help me, like, you know, breath work and yoga and the things, you know, the tools that we have discussed and that we both love. Do I think that's the entirety of the answer? No, I think some aspect of this actually comes back to that I haven't fully connected yet with my essence.
Yep.
The full expanse of whatever that is.
No, and trust me, I'm on the same journey, right? Yeah. We're just at different stages. And I, like they always say, the journey doesn't end. I'm sure there'll be another layer to peel back once I get to where I think I'm meant to be.
Yeah.
What you speak of is not unique to you. Productivity, I always say, has become the disease. Yeah. Mm. So if we're not being productive, we feel like it's not worthwhile. Whatever we're doing isn't of value. Because again, we are conditioned, most of us, to constantly strive. And sitting on the couch and staring out the window at the tree and just enjoying, I don't know, a cup of tea at 9:30 on a Tuesday morning would be like, would give some people heart races.
Yeah. I really resonate with that because I'm like, you're telling me to have a mindful cup of tea? What do you even mean?
But the thing is, people used to do this all the time.
Yeah.
Right? This used to be, and not that long ago. So it's like anything, and it's like you just spoke about, like, what are the things in your life, right, that you were really shit at when you started, but you practiced and practiced and practiced and you got better at them? Give me one example.
The biggest example would probably be speaking, actually, for me.
Yeah, and it's hard and it's uncomfortable and it's terrifying and you're completely exposed and completely vulnerable.
Mm.
Presence is a freaking practice.
Mm.
Okay, it is a practice and it is uncomfortable. And I can trust, like, I've been doing things like meditation and yoga for over 20 years, and sometimes I still struggle to be present. I'm not, you know, the Zen master, but I continue to practice. And that is how you get better at this. And some days it's really hard and some days it's really uncomfortable. But what I see a lot of now is that people say to me, I can't be mindful, I can't meditate, I can't do that because my mind keeps going.
Mm.
And I'm like, that's why you do it. Like, it doesn't stop the mind straight away. It's the showing up on a daily basis to the practice, even if that practice is only 10 minutes. And it doesn't have to be meditation. Like I say, it might be, you know what, if you're not doing anything that makes you present at the moment, it might be setting the goal for yourself for next week and say, you know what, I would like to eat breakfast, like prepare it and eat it without distraction and just be fully in that meal.
Mm.
And I'm going to do that twice next week. Or it might be, I'm going to go for a walk and I'm not going to take any devices. I'm just going to observe the surrounds around me. And if you're not doing that at the moment and you say next week I'm going to do that, I'm going to do it twice and I'll only do it for 15 minutes.
Yeah. And I mean, that sounds like, you know, it doesn't sound like a big deal at all, but I have been without my phone for an hour or two and gone down that road and you literally feel like you've lost a limb. Like we've become so attached to all of these things.
Mm. Why? It's, I mean, I don't know, my gut says to me that when I say why, it's they've created this beautiful mechanism for FOMO. Mm. It's like if the phone is, like, what are you really going to miss in half an hour? Like, that's logical, right? The reality is the world's not going to stop. Things are still going to happen. You're not going to miss the big career opportunity because you didn't respond in half an hour.
Mm.
But we've, again, it's the conditioning that, again, and it's through practice, right? When we first got mobile phones, it wasn't like this, but we committed to the practice, which created an attachment. It created a habit. And now that habit, when we don't have it, like you say, you feel like you're missing a limb. It's because you feel like you might miss something by not being connected. That would be my assumption.
Mm. And so this is, you know, a good segue to the next thing I want to discuss with you today. And that's around the importance of boundaries. You know, boundaries as a high-performing woman, boundaries as a parent, self-care boundaries. Now, we all know we get boundaries are healthy, but if they were that easy to set up and keep in place, we probably wouldn't come up against as many challenges in our lives in relation to our personal well-being and also our ability to be able to, you know, intentionally create purpose and focus in our lives. And so with that in mind, how do you go about setting boundaries and from there managing those boundaries once they're in place?
So there's, I think starting with a decision on where you want to play with boundaries is really helpful.
Mm.
And so one of the things I'm really interested in is there's a psychological boundary theory which speaks to three types of people when it comes to boundaries. There are segmenters. So these are people with, I'm having clearly delineated boundaries, say, between work and life. The two do not cross paths. I leave work at 5 o'clock, I go home, and then this is what happens. There are segmenters, there are integrators. So there are people that say, I'm going to have boundaries, but my boundaries can blend. So I would definitely be one of them. So I might go and do a talk and I might take my son with me and we go on what we call a workation. And I can make that work because I have some boundaries around how that works. So I'm an integrator. And then there's oscillators. So they are people between the two who can do a combination of segmentation and integration. So I always think that's helpful in terms of boundaries don't have to, like, doesn't have to be rigid.
Yeah, yeah? I love that. Understanding the boundaries, boundaries.
Yeah.
The nuances of it all, yeah.
And, again, I think allowing yourself permission to flex in a boundary is helpful as well, providing that you're not flexing every bloody time, right? So for me, for example, if I think of my life and how I set boundaries, I work longer days and am available much longer on a Wednesday and Thursday because they're the days I don't have my son. He's with his dad. But on Monday and Tuesday, often I will finish work at 3 o'clock and I will go and pick up my son. I don't have to, but I want to because he's 13 and God knows how much longer he's going to want me to do that. And we go to soccer training together. We have dinner together. And that is a clear boundary for me on those days. Okay, so allowing yourself flex, I think, is brilliant. And it's the same. I get up 5 o'clock every morning because I love to start my day slow. I love to journal and meditate and move my body. But this morning I felt like I hadn't had enough sleep. And so I didn't get up. Now, it doesn't happen often, but I don't beat myself up because I didn't get up. You know, as long as the boundary is being adhered to, I would say, you know, 80% of the time you're going to be better off than what you are now without any boundary.
And I love that you're coming back to what you said before around being really tuned in to your body, listening to that truest part of yourself that is saying, hey, I actually need to rest right now.
Yeah. And if your body's saying I need to rest all the time, again, that's a signal that maybe you need to go and get an assessment for burnout. Like, The other thing I would say about boundaries, Beck, that I found really interesting because I spent a lot of time researching and then teaching this. It's not hard to, like, I've got this great little process, a great template. It's like, what's the behavior you want to change? Like, what are you doing now in that realm? What would it look like to make progress? So if you did this one or two times a week, what would that look like and how can we set it up? And then let's schedule it in your diary so you've got the time blocked and you can do it. That's not hard. What's hard is actually asking yourself, what is the default behavior that I go to that stops me from doing this thing? And what is the payoff of that default behavior? Understanding that is where the magic lies, right? Because often we ignore it.
So my question for you then is, in your work with all of these women, what are those behaviors?
The first thing that goes for women when they are constantly doing, when they're overloaded, is themselves. And when I say themselves, the first thing is always exercise. It is the movement of the body. And yet if there is one thing we know, there is so much evidence, and from a psychological perspective, the most powerful treatment for psychological, you know, disorders, not to fix them but to help people feel better, is movement. Right. And that is the first thing that goes. So here's the thing. You're feeling exhausted, right? And you take away the one thing that is going to help you feel a little bit better. So it's like a spiral. So that is the first. It's the exercise that goes, or it's the time for themselves. And when I say time, it doesn't have to be hours. It's not going to a day spa. We're not talking about that. It's like, I don't even have 5 minutes to sit on the couch and collect my thoughts. That's what they don't do. The default behavior is putting more into the day, because more into the day takes them away from the pain of how they're really feeling, which is, as I said, often sad.
Yeah. And the other one that's coming up for me is, as you talk there, is around people pleasing. Where does that come from?
Oh.
That's a big one, right? Yeah.
But it's, again, it's a societal one. It's a patriarchal one. Right? So I think there's a beautiful TED talk on this, and I can't remember who did it, but basically, you know, if you think about roles of girls and boys when they're kids, you know, boys are taught to be competitive, to be brave, to be strong, to be resilient, whereas girls are taught to be good. What would a good girl do? Now, it sounds so simplistic, but good girls don't rock the boat. Good girls, you know, they don't disrupt the status quo. They're polite. They're kind. They offer to do things. And what happens is that good girl just tries to get gooder, if that's even a word, as she continues through life, because that's what she's been told her role is and what will get her through. And so that conditioning turns us into good girls become people-pleasing perfectionists because their perception is that's my role, that's what I am meant to be. And again, it's a layer of should, right?
Mm.
It's a layer of should. And that people-pleasing comes at the expense, as you would know, it comes at the expense of their own health and their own happiness. Mm. And we know, you know, when a mother flourishes, a whole family flourishes. But what we see at the moment is many mothers, working mothers, are not flourishing, and the people that they want to elevate are actually suffering as a result of that. So they think giving everything to everyone will fix the problem, but it's the complete opposite. You need to give back to yourself first. It's the oxygen mask, right?
Yeah. So do you think that burnout in high-performing women is a symptom of a lack of gender equality, particularly in regards to how it plays out professionally?
Oh, I think burnout in women is a result of evolution and systems not keeping up with that evolution. So if we look, for example, at corporate jobs, the way that corporate jobs, especially at executive level, is still designed based on a 1960s white male with a wife at home full time as he travels the world and does his job.
Mm.
And now that structure basically, like how many job shares, how many part-time jobs are there at a senior level? Like there are so few. And I'm not saying that's the only answer, but I'm saying we're not even really trying to experiment with a different model that actually serves gender equality being realized. But I don't like to blame the system, right? Because if we sit there and say, oh, well, that it's all the system, then that takes the power away from women having the ability to change it.
Yeah.
So I think it's great to acknowledge where the systemic problems lie, but I don't think we should use that as an excuse to not look at what we can do ourselves to challenge.
Exactly. And if we can change our own lives and honor within ourselves that how we manage our energy as women, as mothers, is going to be fundamentally different to the sort of standardized systems and that are in place from, as you said, from you know, decades of it being that way, that, you know, slowly we can maybe change the system by changing our own lives.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is I remember I sat in a panel years ago for Salesforce at their big conference in Sydney, and it was all around gender equality. And they said, how will we ever realise it? And I don't even know where this came from, but out of my mouth fell, the only way we'll ever realise true gender equality is if men have babies. Because I think that is the other thing, that as women we are fundamentally wired for nurturing, which is caring for others. And that can be caring for our children, it can be caring for our elderly, it can be caring for our pets. And you can't take that away just because a woman wants a career. And I'm not saying men aren't nurturing, like I'm not saying that, but I'm saying there is something innately wired into the role of a mother to nurture. And when you don't have a baby, like when you don't you don't have that, like it's not as innate. And therefore, how can you understand trying to balance that and a career at its essence if you've never felt it at that level, is what I'm saying.
It's it's clear to me that there are many nuances in regards to a conversation about burnout. But what is evident is that our ability to heal offers us all an incredible opportunity to step into personal growth, and that is a beautiful gift. However, to do that really requires, I think, a radical level of truth-telling within ourselves, and it also asks us and really invites us into deep vulnerability. So I want to talk about vulnerability because we hear this term thrown around and we can, you know, at a mental level, we can be like, yeah, I got that. I get what it is to be vulnerable. But that is an entirely different thing to the true surrender required to take that shell off and to be seen in the world and to express all of ourselves. And so what, in your view, is the, not the right way, but a process to allow ourselves to step into vulnerability.
Vulnerability is such a beautiful thing. And again, you talk about your nervous system at the start. Your nervous system will resist it. It'll try and put you into fight or flight, right? Because your whole nervous system is designed to keep you safe, and vulnerability doesn't feel safe. And it's a physiological response. So one of the things that I have done on my journey, which I think as an entrepreneur is somewhere in the realm of 8 years now, that has really served me, and I do it with a lot of my clients, is this simple practice of micro bravery. And so we are all born with a different level of resilience. It's a genetic thing, okay? So we're all born with a different baseline, and it really doesn't matter what your baseline is. All you need to know is that you can enhance your resilience. You can get better at being more courageous, at doing more uncertain and uncomfortable things that are most likely to make you feel like you're more fulfilled and like your life is more meaningful and feel more joy. And so the way you do that is basically every day do one small thing that makes you feel uncomfortable. And that's an act of micro bravery. Don't compare your act of micro bravery to anyone else, because their set point might be completely different to yours. And like me, right, I've been practicing this now for 8 years. So I will do crazy shit now because I don't care. So I'm so much more willing to be vulnerable than I would ever have been in my corporate days, you know, from doing things like keynotes in front of 120 women in bathing suits, for example. Like, that's crazy. Like, I constantly do this now because this practice has enabled me to learn that the fear we create in our heads, the way we think will be exposed more often than not is unlikely to play out. And what sits on the other side of your vulnerability is your potential. And I don't know about you, Beck, but I don't want to get to the end of my life wondering what I could have done because I didn't try. That's just me.
Yeah, and such a powerful reflection. And, you know, I think if we look at vulnerability and understand that, you know, vulnerability and courage are two sides of the one coin. And if we can view courage as essentially an act of being able to see fear as the teacher, we can then lean into love from that place.
Fear is the teacher. Bang on. Like, fear is the teacher, right? Yeah. And again, you're wired to resist it, but everything you ever wanted, I'll guarantee you, that is worthwhile is on the other side of fear.
And it comes back to the work you've done with Gabor around follow the tension.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, even if you take, like, if your listeners take that away, like, it, again, it speaks to, it comes back to busy, right? So we kind of come full circle because busy is a great way to hide the tension within. It's a distraction. And the tension, like he says, pay attention to the tension. If you shine the spotlight on it, you will be astounded at what that tension has to tell you about yourself and about, like you say, how you can unbecome and return to the person that you actually feel or you long to be, but you're struggling to create the space or the know-how for.
And so, Pen, I'd love to talk a little more about the work that you are doing with Dr. Gabor Maté. I had to Google how to pronounce his surname to make sure that I got it correct. Now, I know that what you were studying specifically is compassionate inquiry, which is a psychotherapeutic method that was developed by Dr. Gabor. I have two questions here. Firstly, I want to again loop back into, you know, vulnerability and self-love and some of the themes that we've just spoken about. I personally believe that held trauma will often be the very thing that sabotages our ability to heal from some of the behaviors that we've spoken about today that are actually causing us to burn out in the first place. So as a psychologist, and given your current studies, I'm interested if you can talk specifically about the connection between trauma and our ability to heal burnout and generally speaking, our ability to self-actualize as human beings.
So I have to disqualify, I'm not a psychologist yet.
Nearly.
So I think the first thing, before I'd studied trauma, my definition of trauma was quite different to what I know it to be now. So I think the first thing is to clarify what trauma is. And Gabor says this beautifully. Trauma is not what happens to you. It's what happens inside of you as a result of that experience.
Mm.
Okay. And I think this is important to understand because you and I could have exactly the same experience and I could walk away traumatized and you could walk away like nothing ever happened. Mm.
So it's the distinction between the pain and the suffering.
Basically, trauma is a physiological response.
Mm.
So it's what goes on inside of you based on your perception of what's going on outside.
Mm.
So an experience happens, you have a perception of that experience, which creates a set of feelings which will trigger a physiological response, especially if those feelings are threatening. And that physiological response basically creates, it's a safety mechanism. So every time you have that feeling triggered again in any way, shape or form, completely unrelated to an experience like the one you had, this is where a trigger comes in, your brain, which is a pattern recognition machine, goes, what happened last time we did that and how did we respond? And your body basically goes into override and responds. It's why often we can have a response and go, oh, my God, where did that even come from?
Mm.
Okay. So that's the first thing I would say. Trauma is what happens inside of you as a response to what happens in the outside world.
Hmm. This is a kind of a separate example, but it reminded me of it because I ran into someone who I'd had a falling out with quite a significant time ago, ran into them and the conversation was fine. It was all cool. But just observing the reaction in my body, it's just exactly what you're talking about. My whole body just went, poof.
Because again, coming back, it's an autonomic response, right? Your nervous system has kicked in and said, okay, what did we do last time? We need to protect her.
Mm.
Do the same thing. Make her safe. Mm. Now, it's trying to protect you and make you feel safe, but often that protection mechanism, that safety, can be maladaptive.
Mm.
It can actually act as you were saying before, how does that stop people from returning to themselves? Without understanding the feeling that's presented, so what's the trigger? What's the feeling that sits behind that? Where did that feeling come from?
Mm.
What was the experience that happened when that feeling was first felt? What was the perception you had of that experience? What did you tell yourself as a result of that? So often, for example, it might be something like, it could be anything from childhood. A woman told me the other day when she was 3 years old, her mother had a stillborn. She came home from the hospital. Her grandmother and her mother were in the lounge room. Her mother was crying. She was 3 years old. She saw her mother crying. She wanted to go and console her, and her grandmother shooed her out the room.
Mm.
And she, from that, that's a trauma for her, right? Because from that experience, she believed that she wasn't wanted. She was not wanted, and she didn't speak to anyone about it. And so that not feeling wanted now gets triggered whenever she feels like someone is asking her to be quiet, asking her to, step aside.
Got a set of algorithms in our body that are just waiting to be activated based on the stimulus that is occurring in the external world, regardless of whether that stimulus is actually threatening or not. If the message is the same, the body responds in the same way.
If the message is interpreted
the same way.
So it's all down to your perception, right?
Yeah.
How your body perceives the situations. But you're absolutely right. And it's Gabor says, and I love this, he says, we are a prisoner of our childhood.
Mm.
So we don't realize it, but that they talk about that little Beck inside or that little Penny. We've all got that inner child within us. And that inner child and the trauma that little child has experienced, not war-torn country trauma, that's not for all of us. I'm saying the trauma might be as simple, like for me, it was my parents' divorce. Like, I look at how that's impacted me, my brother and my sister. Like, that's a, we have a collective trauma. But how it's physiologically manifested for the three of us is completely different. Completely different from addiction to anxiety through to someone who just fucking pushes through.
Yeah.
You know, I was the resilient one, so I just learned to get on with it, get on with it. And what I'd done suppressed how I was feeling for so long that after doing this work with Gabor, like, I literally have exploded. And it's like 37 years of a conversation that's been dying to come out, came out. That was vulnerable.
Oh, yeah. That's big work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could talk about this stuff all day. It's fascinating. So the other thing that I think is worth highlighting, Beck, because, you know, the work that you're doing and where, you know, I imagine your listeners are at, is trauma creates a disconnection from self.
Yeah.
Because, again, what your body does is it shuts down a part of you that is too painful.
And hence why we're constantly working over the top of that, whether that be in the, you know, I'm too busy, or I if I stop, I don't know who I am and I feel unsafe. Well, why do you feel unsafe? Because in some cases we have this iceberg there that is, you know, that you in essentially in stopping, you're creating space for those things to start to come to the surface if they're there.
Absolutely. And the other thing that I think is fascinating, and like again, there's so much evidence to suggest this is a true thing. Some trauma is so painful that the brain actually goes offline. And so whilst the trauma is stored in the subconscious, you can have people that have no recollection whatsoever of that traumatic experience, even though they experienced it and it happened to them. Sexual abuse is a perfect example. There are many examples, but your brain, like, again, to keep you safe, actually shuts down so that that memory is not in your conscious. But because it's in your subconscious, it will still trigger you, it will still impact you, and it will impact your behavior. You just can't connect to why without the right support.
So, Pen, I'm going to loop into a parenting question here, because you mentioned before what Gabor had said in relation to being prisoners to our childhood. And, you know, I let that sit for a minute when you said that, because often the way that knowing that, like, it's one thing to get that and you're like, yep, okay, you become all of a sudden aware of how your own childhood has impacted the trajectory of your adult life, and then you realize the responsibility you have as a mother in creating conditions for your own child's life that are going to fundamentally influence who they are in the world and the responsibility of that. How are you working with that?
I have a theory, and it's probably not what people want to hear, but it's working for me, right? So my belief is it's not a matter of whether you will create trauma for your child. It's the degree to which you create trauma for your child.
So true.
So the reality is you will fuck them up, right? You cannot help it, because I could sit here and, I don't know, it's going to sound ridiculous, I could have a surprise party for my son and he turns up and he's completely humiliated because he's a teenager. Like, it sounds ridiculous, right? For him, though, that might actually be a traumatic traumatic event. But for me, I'm trying to be a good parent. And so this is what I'm saying. I don't sit there and dance around trying to stop trauma. As long as I'm trying to keep him I always love Dr. Jordan Peterson. I once read he said, do you want your child to be safe or do you want them to be strong? And I want Sax to be strong. Safe, yes, in terms of house over his head, and safe in terms of not being, you know, abused and that sort of stuff. But I want him to be strong of mind and body so that he can navigate this stuff from a place, you know, from his own space without needing me to do it for him for the rest of his life. So I accept that I'm gonna fuck him up. It's the degree to which I do it. So for me, it's about risk minimization.
Yeah. And this is a difficult thing, given we're perfectionist, high-performing women who want to be perfect parents, the vulnerability of kind of accepting that at the same time, that it's not going to be perfect here.
No. I think, Beck, one of the most powerful things I ever did with Sax, and I did it from a very young age, and it was not even it just came out, and I don't know how, was when he was younger, he asked me a question and he said to me, "How do I know you're telling me the truth?" And I remember that, I can't even remember what the question was. Like, it might have been something sexual, you know, like whatever. Like,
yeah.
And he said, "How do I know you're telling the truth?" And I said, "Here's my promise to you. If you ask me a question, I will always tell you the truth. But in return for that, if I ask you a question, I expect the same."
Mm.
So if we can agree on that, I said, you'll never get in trouble for telling the truth, yeah, even if it's a horrible truth. But if we have that basis, it's a good place for us to work from. And the stuff that he, I'm sure he doesn't tell me everything, but for a 13-year-old boy, the questions he asks me and the stuff he tells me, I'm pretty confident that I'm okay with knowing where he's at this point in life off the back of that.
Mm. And so let's dive back into your work studying with Gabor again for a second. I really want to understand what compassionate inquiry is all about.
Mm. Changed my life.
I'm dying to learn all about this. I could spend hours with you talking about all of this.
So we as humans are innately wired to judge one another. And I fundamentally believe that's because, you know, we're animals at the end of the day, and animals love hierarchy, you know, often. And the reason we judge one another, it's so that we can place ourselves and others in a hierarchy. It's not even, well, sometimes it's not even conscious. It's just the way we are. But what happens with that, especially like Gabor does a lot of work with people with addiction, and addiction is a perfect example of people suppressing trauma. It's a coping mechanism. And so compassionate inquiry is not, it's an approach. It's not about saying, right, here's the rigid, this is the way things are done. It is an approach that you bring your essence, yourself to. But it's about saying, if we come to the table and seek to understand this person's pain from a place of compassion, so from a place of love and understanding and support, rather than from a place of judgment and wrong and broken and wanting to fix, and just hold the space for that person to feel safe, for that person to feel cared for, so that they can explore and unpack the trauma in a way that enables them to feel freer and like they can be who they are. That's how I would describe compassionate inquiry. But the beautiful thing about it, Beck, is you can't deliver it to others unless you do the work on yourself. And doing that work in the last 6 months has, at 38 years old, has been the most powerful thing I've ever done. Because the simple question that I now ask myself every day, that I never asked myself for 38 years, when I wake up, if I feel, you know, overwhelmed, like I'm not enough, whatever it is, I ask myself, what would self-compassion look like for me today? And it is a beautiful question to ask.
So I've come towards the end of the podcast. What I want to ask you is, do you feel that there is anything that you haven't already shared across the course of today's conversation that would be really important for our audience to know from you at this exact point in time?
I would share with your audience, if this has resonated and you're one of these high-functioning, burnt-out women that we're speaking of, one of the most beautiful things that you can do for yourself at the end of the day is a beautiful little mantra that I love, which is basically saying, I am enough and that is enough. And, again, it comes back to this practice of self-compassion and acknowledging that you are and you always were enough, because I just feel so many women consistently feel like they're not enough, and that's certainly not going to serve you in being the mum, in being the woman, in being the career person that you want to be.
Mm. Penny Licasso, speaking to you is like literally a heart explosion for me. I have loved every minute of this podcast, and I have no doubt that there would be listeners who want to learn more about your work, might want to buy your book, jump on booking a breakthrough call with you. Where can they find you?
You can find me on hackinghappy.co. You'll also find me on LinkedIn and Instagram. But thanks, Bec. It's been an absolute pleasure. You asked some beautiful questions.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining me on the DNA of Purpose podcast. Thank you, as always, for dedicating your time to the DNA of Purpose podcast. As we conclude today's episode, I invite you to extend the conversation online. Feel free to reach out via LinkedIn or follow along at Rebecca Maklad, that is M-A-K-L-A-D, on Instagram, where we're crafting a tapestry of stories, reflections, tools, and insights to empower your purpose-driven leadership strategy. I love feedback, and we always welcome guest suggestions. Should today's episode ignite a spark within you, reviews really do help us to continue to attract the world's most prominent purpose-driven leaders as our guests. And if you know somebody who would benefit from one of our episodes, then share that story with abundance. A big thanks to Supernova Tribe, who produce this podcast with style, and Guide Your Light, a network for podcasts with purpose.